The following programming is sponsored by Salts Mangaluzzi Bendeschi. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, we're in the Delaware Valley. Welcome to the Salts Mangaluzzi Bendeschi Hour. We've got a fantastic show. We have Benjamin Baer, partner of Salts Mangaluzzi Bendeschi, and David Langsam, also a partner at Salts Mangaluzzi Bendeschi, on the broadcast. Gentlemen, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having us. Excited to be here.
Thank you, sir. It's pleasure's all ours.
The pleasure's mine, and certainly it is great to be here. I love where we're sitting. Always, this is I'll keep saying it on the podcast. Fact is, the White House is the unfair advantage, the foreign heads of state. Well, here we are on the 52nd floor of Liberty One, looking out over the. This, I mean, it's just an incredible, like Joe Krause says, radio is theater of the mind. The setting is unbelievable.
You're not afraid of heights, are you?
I was an iron worker. And, hold on. And started. I started on Liberty 2. I started the job at the top, literally on the 60th floor. So, but by the way, I did it for a long time. Guess what? I can't believe I did it. And you'd have to. There ain't enough money to get me out there on the ledge. Of course, that was some time ago. So having said that, Ben, if you will, introduce yourself, obviously, to the listeners. Tell a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Yeah. Again, thank you for having me. It's my first time on the show, and I am excited to be here. So I am Ben Baer. I am, as you said, a partner here at Salts Mangaluzzi. I've been with the firm just over a decade. I do primarily product liability litigation. We do catastrophic injury, workplace injury, all types. As many of my colleagues and partners on the show have said it, if you get badly injured, you can give us a call and we'll look into the case. Prior to joining the firm, I did just shy of 5 years at the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. So I was across the street working as a prosecutor, which really fabulous experience right out of law school, getting cases, trying cases, learning what to say and do in a courtroom, perhaps in lower stakes types of cases I was handling over there compared to what we do day to day here. But having that opportunity to learn and take that knowledge with me after about 5 years in the prosecutor's office, fortunate enough to be offered a position here by Bob Mangaluzzi and have been here since.
Absolutely. And we'd be remiss if we didn't point out your father, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court Chief Justice, Max Baer, and our condolences go out to yourself and your family. The loss of a great man, and obviously, and like I told you before on the labor show, deservingly so, we recognized him, and so our thoughts and prayers go to you and your family.
Well, on behalf of my family and myself, thank you so much. I appreciate it. I'm obviously biased, but I my father was an amazing man, and I'll just say that the outpouring, text messages, phone calls, visitation, people coming over, has just been overwhelming. So I do appreciate your words as well as all the others who. I haven't even had a chance to get back with, and I'm trying to do now. We're hanging in there. Our family is gonna sure miss my dad, but we're hanging in there and taking it a day at a time. But thank you for the kind words.
Absolutely. Having said that, no way to properly segue from that conversation. But I'm gonna introduce David Langsam. Partner, again, David, if you would, a little bit about yourself and obviously your practice. You're not a stranger to the broadcast, but this is the first time I believe you're on your firm's show.
Yep.
Remind our listeners a little bit about yourself and your practice.
Yeah, sure. So, Joe, thanks for having me on here. I appreciate it. As you said, I've had the pleasure of your company before on one of these shows. It was at a different office with some other friends of mine, but nevertheless, I do appreciate the opportunity. So I have had the pleasure of being here now for 13 years. And I guess it's one of those things where they say that when you find yourself in a good situation, you don't want to mess with it. So during law school, I had the opportunity to come in and spend a summer here, and I figured once I got my foot in the door, I'd try to keep it there and not let the door close, and so far, so good.
Right.
It's been a wonderful thing, and...
You're coming in with the key fob and making sure it works all the time.
Yeah, well, listen...
But you're still here, right?
Sometimes...
Must be doing something right.
Hopefully there's not a day when you try to get through the turnstile downstairs and like, oh, crap.
Oh, it happens to me. You just hop the turnstile. You just keep coming in. It'll work out.
It's yeah, awesome. It is. It's good. It's been a wonderful ride, and God willing, it continues into the future. So I initially, when I was here as a law clerk, and then early on after passing the bar, practiced primarily in the medical malpractice field. And that didn't last particularly long because there was a need on the other side of the office where we were doing much more in the world of workplace-type accidents,
sure,
product liability work, which is really what I spent a lot of time doing, is product liability work and you know, all types of workplace accident investigation and litigation. And it's been a while, but yeah, this guy here, Ben and I, we've been playing in the same sandbox for that decade, and it's been a fun ride.
Well,
go ahead, Ben.
This is, he asked us to introduce ourselves, and we just won't stop talking. But
no,
I was going to say, hearing that you've been here for 13 years, obviously you've been here longer than I have, and I appreciate that. But hearing you say that made me think, wow, we've been here a long time. I remember when we were the new guys, the youngsters at the firm, and you sort of blink, and all of a sudden there's a whole new crop of young attorneys here. So it's kind of it's only been 10 years for me. So, but it's been good to work here with David and on our team.
Well, you know, you say it does say a lot about a workplace. Reminds me of Ron Wood with the Rolling Stones. He joined the band in 1975, and he's still the new guy, right? he still feels like he just joined the band. But 10 years, 13 years, and obviously passionate about what the firm does. That says something about the firm. When you have a longevity with your team, and this is a serious place, and you deal with catastrophic injuries at all levels. And I've always, we talked about it the last time we, talked on the show, Dave, but firms from all over the country refer their cases here. Talk about that and the relevance of that, because having the resources to be, to take a case, the distance, no matter what the situation is important. And there's a good reason why firms that even obviously good small boutique firms, but mid-sized firms, the phone doesn't stop ringing here. Talk about that, Ben.
Oh, no. As what you said, I agree with you and I appreciate the compliment. We are experts in what we do, if I can say that. We
sure
sort of are specialized in how we go about it. We're very fortunate to work here in Bob Mongaluzzi's firm, where, there is no shortage of financial resources. If we have a case, obviously, it needs to be the right kind of case to apply the resources. But it's wonderful to work in a place with such expertise, other attorneys to speak with and to discuss cases, and then also to have really an unlimited budget to investigate. If we have a novel issue, we'll go get the best experts in the world. We'll round table it with the finest, I'm just going to say it, the best lawyers in the country work here. And David and I, I'm not talking about us, although I think we're excellent attorneys, but we can go knock on the door of Bob Mongaluzzi, Larry Bendesky, Dave Quast, Drew Duffy, and have these conversations that are just next level on what to do and how to really thoroughly investigate these cases to do the absolute best for our clients. And, I think a benefit of our job is that we share our knowledge with other attorneys, and that's something that we take very seriously, that, if we have an aerial lift tip over case, and it's a defective product that's going to happen in Western Pennsylvania, it's going to happen in Northeastern Pennsylvania, it's going to happen here in the Philadelphia area, well, it's happening all over the country. And so we will be advocates, and we will be working with attorneys across the country, in California, in Texas, you name it, we're there. Just trying to do best for the clients, the individuals who are either horribly injured or killed.
It's interesting, product liability. When I think of it, okay, I think of, you know, some product that's, you know, that's broken, you know, that seems, you talk about workplace construction accidents and also relate them to product liability. Talk about the wide array of that, what that means, product liability, from a defective, thingamajig to a workplace accident. Talk about the wide array of types of product liability.
Sure. So the broad distinction between what we do and what some of our friends that sit across the table, the defense bar, what they do, is we play a long game, and they don't. And what I mean by that is, and it's really a great way, at least for me, to illustrate the distinction between the two types of cases, is one really implicates engineering and design and thought processes that take years to get to the finish line. A car, you got a model year 2022 car, the design of that started 7 years ago. And all of the steps that go into getting that car into production, or if it's a different type of consumer product, or an industrial product, or a commercial product, whatever, it's the same logic. You've got people that are really smart, that have lots of certificates and frames on their walls, that put the time into coming up with, what are we trying to do? What are the risks associated with what we're trying to do? What are the ways in which we're going to protect people from what we're trying to do? Whereas the workplace stuff, the way that defense lawyers typically look at this, is what happened at the moment that someone got hurt. That person had 5 seconds to react to a particular situation, and he or she didn't make the right decision in the moment, which is the distinction. One, a product liability case focuses on the product. What is it about the product that these folks had 6 or 7 years to design that could have taken the human element out of it? And instead of focusing on what happened at the very end of the story, immediately before someone gets hurt, let's talk about how we could have taken the decision-making and boots on the ground completely out of the equation.
Talk about the creative process. I say that because, you know, you hear of cases that so many firms or attorneys looked at and didn't see it. Okay, like, for example, somebody who gets injured on a job, and they clearly were working alone. They stuck their hand into something and or whatever. But then, you know, and they get, and it's a work comp case, yeah. But, and somebody will say, well, you know, it, you know, you got hurt at work. It's not a case. But then, you know, it's almost, it seems to me like it might be like, you know, looking, you know, at the forest or the trees. In other words, trying to, you know, talk about what you need to do sometimes to see, okay, there's a third party there, there's a negligent situation, and maybe it's the product, maybe it's the machine. Talk about that.
So, and I think most people get this, but the general rule in Pennsylvania is you are unable to sue your employer
right.
if they provide you with workers' compensation.
Correct.
And that's a longer conversation in of itself. But when we get these cases, as you alluded to, Joe, then the question is, okay, so this person's horribly injured. Is there anything we can do to help him, help her, help the family? And it's as simple, I think, as just, you know, critical analysis, hard work, and, you know, being willing to take some risk on our end to try to help an individual. So if you have someone who's injured on a workplace, you know, the question is, okay, so the employer is immune, and that's the system, and that's accepted. Is there a supervisory company? Is there someone else that had overall site safety responsibility? Often in construction, the answer is yes. You know, and then it's a matter of, you know, fact-finding and determining if they had an obligation to provide a safe work environment and failed to do so, in which case they could be responsible. And you need to have the ability to, understand the intricacies of the Pennsylvania law, understand the roles and responsibilities of different people, and that's one of the reasons that we have expertise in that field. You know, I have the analogous situation recently where we had a case young man with a family was working underneath a load that he probably should not have been underneath, and a heavy load fell from an overhead crane and rendered him quadriplegic. Never going to walk again, limited use of his hands, horrific injuries, and was rejected by three firms that said, well, this is a workers' comp case because he's working for his job. He's the only guy, and they paid his comp. And the case came to us, and we roundtabled it and thought, and, you know, the hook that had the load that was manufactured in the 1940s or 50s didn't have a safety latch on it. And so instead of just saying, well, he was injured at work, we said, well, why is there no safety latch to secure this load? We got into the case. We did investigation, determined that in order for it to be in a fit-for-service condition, you have to have a safety latch. And then there was a deep dive analysis as to if, in fact, it was original equipment or if it had been modified. And we're talking about going back 80 years and tracing the life of this crane from original manufacturer up until date of incident, which was not easy to do and took a considerable amount of time, work, and energy. But we got that case into a position where we were able to have a pretty, I don't want to say anything inappropriate, but we had a pretty decent recovery for a guy who had been told by three different attorneys, we're sorry, we can't help you. And that in and of itself made me feel really good that we were able to help this family when they had been told no numerous times, and it just sort of got to us just in the nick of time where we were able to step in and help.
I'll tell you, that's exactly what I was talking about, seeing the forest through the trees. And they've talked about the experience here and the luxury and the value that brings to the table to be able to, you know, like Ben said, having that resource that I'm at a you know, in a room right now where I can only imagine, you know, the resources of the individual sitting at this table.
Okay. It's a big table, right?
It's a big table.
It's a long table, lots of chairs.
That's right, lots of them. and so, having said that, having that experience and somebody, you know, it reminds me of just kind of looking at a picture, going, something's here. I just don't know what it is, but what's on the line is somebody's, I mean, the future, you know, the existence of their life, what quality of life is there, what, you look at, first thing I thought of is maybe the straps, you know, I mean, mm-hmm. the chokers or something like that, that may have broke.
Right.
But, you know, having that resource where you see, you know, you have a Bob Mongo who says, you know, sitting there, you know, or Duffy or one of you guys that say, I got that. I have an eye, you know, that have seen that. What's that value to you as a partner?
It's invaluable, and I think the value extends to the clients in a very meaningful way, and actually in a couple of meaningful ways. First and foremost, and at least the way that I try to approach things, is I'm not a sugarcoater, and it works in a couple of different ways. One, we don't want to waste anyone's time. I don't want to give anyone the false expectation of a particular outcome when it's not necessarily the case. We'll be objective, and at a minimum, we'll get answers to questions, because a lot of folks come in with lots of questions, and if nothing else, we can do our best to get answers to them. But the other part of it, too, is we need to be very, very diligent at the beginning. When we're investigating a case, the worst possible scenario is putting a case into litigation, working for a couple of years, and then you get a bad outcome. Doesn't help anybody. And clients, first and foremost, are upset by it. They have gone through the litigation process that they didn't necessarily need to go through if it had been properly vetted at the beginning. But we ain't reinventing any wheels.
Sure.
And there are lots of things that we do, lots of case types that we handle, where we can be efficient. We can, at the very, very early stages, take a look at what it is that we're presented with and, one, think outside of the box, and, two, call on our own experience, the experience of all of the folks that we have in this office, and get a sense relatively quickly as to whether or not there is something viable.
Talk about the vetting process. You know, we've all self-diagnosed ourselves, you know, on a medical level. We all have, you know, so, you know, this
Google
is
MD.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Right. Exactly. This is what's wrong. In your world, everybody's got a case, right? I know I got a case. Trust me. I had a buddy call me up not long ago. He was in a hospital, and I do obviously a lot of legal radio. And so I'm not pretending to know, you know, anything, but he says to me, he's whispering to me on the phone. He's like, shh, I'm suing the lawyer. Right? I'm like, he's like, hey, I got a medical malpractice case. I'm like, listen, his name's Joe. Just in case he's listening to the show, he knows who he is. And I'm like, listen, Joe, I'm not a lawyer. I don't, you know, pretend to know anything, but you don't have a case. You know what I mean? In other words, but that's on a funny note. You know, I guess it was a ridiculous thing. But in real life, there can be some, you know, really serious situations. And I can't, you know, we're actually going to do a radio show called Case or No Case. Okay.
And ooh, I like that.
You like it?
Yeah.
Right, well, I already copyrighted it. I'm just kidding.
I'll be listening.
Yeah, wait a minute. Hold on. I just realized you guys have all them resources. I'm screwed. Anyway, having said that, talk about the vetting process, because that's really where, you know, where the rubber hits the road. You know what I mean? You know, where you make a decision on talk about what goes through when you're vetting a case, and sometimes how long it can take, and you sometimes spend some decent, you know, funds vetting a case before you decide whether you're going to accept it.
Well, yeah. So in terms of vetting cases, you know, we're ultimately looking for two things, right? There's two sides to every case. There's the liability, who's responsible, and then there's the injuries, the damages. I learned this from Bob Mongaluzzi, but, you know, at times when we'll meet with a client, we say, well, we hope you have the very worst case in the firm. In other words, we hope that you're not injured. We hope that you get better, you make 100% recovery, you're perfect, in which case you don't have a case, which is better for you, because the people that really need our services are the ones that have experienced tragedy. In with the amount of attorneys we have here at the firm and the types of cases that we handle all types of cases. So we do have practice groups that will do of the more minor injury type stuff. David and I, our practice group, is really that catastrophic injury is what we're handling. So we, unfortunately, for the people that call us, they don't call us because they had a good day.
Yeah.
Right? These are people that have lost somebody. These are people that are horrifically burned. These are people that are in wheelchairs and don't have the ability to, you know, move their legs or arms. So what we are ultimately looking at from a high level are you badly injured? And if so, is there some party, some entity, some company, some, you know, whether it be a car manufacturer with a poorly designed vehicle? We could get down into specifics and talk about all the various types of cases that come in the door. But it's not the specific type of case that comes in the door. It's, okay, this person was injured. Now you'd be a little bit of a detective and figure out what happened. It's not always as obvious as it would seem. Some cases are, right? But some cases involve that, okay, you know, something's not right here. This person was horribly injured. What went wrong? Why did it happen? How it could have been prevented? And why wasn't it prevented? And more often than not, it could have been. And it's the ability to determine and figure out what should have occurred, and then go do the work and take the discovery and depose the necessary people and take corporate designee depositions, that is people that speak on behalf of the defendant companies, and get the admissions that they either knew about it or they should have known about it, and they didn't make the changes that they needed to. So I may have lost part of the question
there. No, but you know, we're talking about vetting a case, and
yeah.
How lengthy can that get, David? And on the high end, how expensive can that get? Because this is a contingency fee agreement we're talking about.
100%. All our cases, yeah.
Yeah, and explain the Ben, if you will, a contingency
fee. Well, it's as simple as we don't get paid unless we win money for you. So we take the cases. We don't represent insurance companies. We don't represent corporations. So you never get a bill in the mail from us for having a phone call or for writing a letter or something like that. I couldn't live my life like that, where I got to keep track of my hours. So what we do is I'm not wired that way.
And you know, having said that, you know, how extensive can the vetting of the case get? Dave, in other words, you know, you may invest in this before and then ultimately say no, it's not something you can. So you're willing to go the distance. Talk about that.
Yeah, sure. And it really depends on the type of case that we're talking about. But there's a couple of aspects of it. The first is when I said a couple of minutes ago that we ain't reinventing any wheels. The investigation in a scenario involving a type of case that's something we've dealt with, perhaps more frequently than others, takes less time, and we can do it internally. We don't necessarily need to call on any outside resources, any experts in a particular field, whether medical or otherwise.
That's the benefit of having the experience in the room, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And just by hearing the facts, looking at a couple pictures, taking Google Earth or Google Street View trips, we can get pretty close to that finish line. So that's just one scenario. Then there's others that are a little bit more complex, perhaps because it's something that we haven't necessarily worked on before. That doesn't happen particularly often, but from time to time. But if it is, for example, a product liability case, more so in the context of cars, right? So one of the things that we do, and we do a lot of, is what's called crashworthiness. That's a fancy term for we sue car manufacturers because they make defective cars. And they do. They make defective cars. And one thing that we do as part of our process here when we take those cases is we have to evaluate whether we can piece together all of the small pieces of the puzzle and paint a picture that here's what the outcome was. We know how it happened because it's either been told to us or we've seen it. We know how someone got hurt. Let's work backwards. What can we do to show that if this thing would have been made differently somehow, some way, that the outcome would have been different? And then if we can figure out how the outcome would have been different, then you got to hire someone that's done it for a living. Got to tell you, maybe it's surprising, maybe not. There's not a lot of product design engineers that work for big car manufacturers or tire manufacturers that are willing to get involved in cases on behalf of injured folks and go ahead and say, you manufacturer, you did this in the wrong way. You designed a defective product. In those cases, right, where you need to get these disciplines involved, engineers and doctors and pathologists and all that jazz, which is a good bit of the caseload we have, that takes a little bit longer. That can take months. And again, it's a double-edged sword. You want to be thorough, but by the same token, you want to try to be efficient at the same time. So depending on the type of case, you're talking about a pretty significant financial outlay, which gets to what I mentioned before, which is you do your evaluation early because you don't want that surprise from the client perspective, from a business perspective at the 11th hour after you're so heavily invested. So some of these more complex cases where we're talking about cars and things of that nature, you're handsomely spending, you know, 50 grand, maybe more, just to get to maybe sometimes. Once you get the cases in and you have to go the full distance, you're talking hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And to me, the contingency fee agreement is the great equalizer. You know, you somebody gets the opportunity to walk in these offices right here, okay, in this boardroom, and have some of the greatest attorneys on the planet that they could never afford out of their own pocket. It gives me the chills, really, because what you're saying, you're talking about vetting a case and spending money before you even make a decision. I'm sure you have said, listen, what are the factors in and I don't mean liability and finding negligence and liability and insurance and those things. I'm talking about determining whether there's enough there to actually take it. You may determine and say, you know what, there's a case here, but we're going to go to distance potentially, and there's going to be nothing left for the client.
Well, it just depends on how badly injured the client is. If it's permanent injury, if they're going to be able to get back to work. You know, for example, and I was thinking of different cases we've had against car manufacturers, but it's expensive to sue major automotive manufacturers in the United States of America. So if you have injuries that are that sort of soft tissue, a broken bone, but you're going to mend and heal, and in a month or two, you're back to work, and
sure,
it's a bad memory, and you're on your way, you know, that's not the type of case where we can justify spending $250,000 to go sue, Ford or whoever it may be. So really, for that type of case, in order for the in a one-off, in a personal injury lawsuit, as opposed to class action or mass tort, which is a whole other ball game, where you do have strength in numbers and things can be different. But in our cases where we're just representing a single plaintiff against an automotive company, you need to have some sort of serious injury, something that's permanent, that's going to impact you for the rest of your life for the most part and prevent you from going back to work. In Pennsylvania, pain, suffering, loss of life's pleasures, that kind of stuff that we're going to be able to show the jury that it's really altered your life in a very negative way with some permanency.
Talk about what a client can expect when they come and retain the two of you on a case. You've determined it's a case that you're willing to accept. What can they expect in regards to communications? Yeah. Also the relationship. Creating an amicable relationship with somebody who, by the way, it might they're either catastrophically injured or their loved one, or maybe it's even a wrongful death.
Yeah.
What can they expect when they walk through these doors?
So, I take my client relationships very, very seriously, and I think that it creates a level of comfort in an otherwise uncomfortable situation because I make myself available all the time. Now, my cell number's out there, email, phone number, everything. And I encourage, and oftentimes clients take advantage of it, text me. Text me whenever something comes up. I got a 5-3 and 1-year-old, and my wife has a crazy call schedule, so I'm always awake. It doesn't matter. And I will get back to you. But the journey from inception to getting a case resolved, either taking it to trial or getting it done in an out-of-court settlement, this is hard. It's hard. And whether it's the person who's injured that you're representing or the family of the loved one that is no longer here, there are so many questions and so many emotions that go through it, through the entire process, that it's really nice to serve, as the counselors, or they call us counselors.
Yeah.
And that's the one thing. But the other thing, I do want to add, is I have formed some really, really close bonds with former clients now at this point, and some current ones, so much so that the most flattering thing that happens to us is when our adversaries that sit across deposition tables and are at other, counsel tables at trial, or the defense lawyers that we go to battle against, when they send their cases to us, when they refer their injured family members or friends or others that they know about to us. But to me, a very, very close second, if not tied with that, is when our clients or former clients are so satisfied with the outcomes, but perhaps more so the level of emotional connection,
yes,
and communication that
absolutely
they send their own family members and friends to us.
Yeah, and setting expectations, because no matter how obvious something seems, setting expectations, yeah, with a client really from day one, because,
So, Joe, if I can jump in, because I wanted to say this just because in response to your last question, I have a conversation with every client, every new client I have, and I'm very clear that, what you're going to get from me is the truth. I am going to give it to you straight. And I know David does the same. I'll never lie to you, good or bad. I'm going to give it to you because you need to know what's going on. And so you need to have that, knowledge going into it that we're going to have an open relationship. It's going to be very forthright and honest, because if your lawyer is afraid to give you the bad news and only sunshine and rainbows, they're not doing their job as an advocate preparing you for what's to come. And I also say that, you need to have a very high comfort level with your attorney, because this, as we mentioned before, we're going to take a case. The pre-suit investigation could go on for months on the short side, could be a full year, if not more, pre-suit investigation. Then the case gets into litigation, and depending on your jurisdiction, at the earliest, it's going to be a 2 years. At the longest, I've had cases in certain jurisdictions, this keeps me up at night, where cases linger for many more years than they should. But you're going to have that, you need to have that relationship with your lawyer. where, you know, you have the trust that they're doing what they need to do on your behalf, and that it's going to be a long road and you're going to be in this together. And you need to have that ability to communicate and trust that you can ultimately be successful. And if I'm not the right guy for you, that's okay. It's business. I understand that. But, you know, that's what you need to have when you retain a lawyer. And I find that when you have those conversations and you are a straight shooter with the clients, that resonates, and because it's true.
Sure.
And that's what you need to do. At least that's what's been successful for me.
Yeah, and it's interesting because that sincerest form of flattery, when a former client, you know, refers you to somebody, you know, this on a much different scale. You know, you go to a restaurant, the food might be great, but if the service is terrible, or if somebody was, you remember that. Okay.
Sure.
You're going through a case for 2 years or more.
Yeah.
Okay. That relationship has to be paramount, you know, and, you know, especially, you know, when somebody's referring you, you know, future cases. Dave, you mentioned one of your strengths, and I think you mentioned it, talking about thinking outside the box, okay? And I talk about that and what it means.
Yeah, and I think that looking at a situation with an open mind, either at the beginning of the investigation process or once we actually start digging into things, is an important step because it helps distinguish us from what it is we're able to do and the results that we're able to achieve. But there are so often times where we get to represent folks that had already been with a lawyer.
Yeah.
And they're here for a host of different reasons, one of which is they didn't communicate with me, or I didn't think that they were interested in working hard to represent my interests. I was like, okay, well, that's kind of what the job is. Right. Got to do a little bit of digging. And right. Once you dig a little bit deeper, oftentimes you find out something that you may not necessarily have expected. And listen, without the benefit of a court order or a subpoena, there's certain information that we've got limited access to. So one of the things we talked about before, how long does the investigation take? Well, let's say it's a workplace incident. OSHA investigates. OSHA, under federal regulation, has 6 months from the date of the incident to do their investigation unless they decide to cite the employer, and the employer fights it, and then it can get drug out longer. But we don't have that power. We don't have federal subpoena power, but OSHA does. So they are able to gather a lot of information for us, and a lot of it's publicly accessible. We have to make a request for it and then wait in line for it, but we can get it that way. So in that sense, we've got access perhaps to some information we otherwise wouldn't. But without a court order, without a subpoena, we can Google stuff, we can look stuff up. But if you look at a situation that at first blush may not necessarily be a viable case, well, just look at it the other way, right? Just change your perspective. And once you do that, and listen, I could rattle off a bunch of examples. And I think the last time, Joe, I had the pleasure of your company, I probably did share one. But there are so many ways once you move forward with the case and you start getting into it, asking the right question, asking the creative question,
sure,
looking at an angle that you may not have otherwise.
And that's what I was talking about, yeah, creativity-wise. I mean, it, as much as you have to be a high thinker, having that creative, you know, not to see something for, you know, just face value has got to be important.
Yeah, and, you know, I was thinking of a couple examples, and, you know, we're trying to find the truth, right? We want to know what happened. We want to figure this out. Sometimes that leads you down a path where you say, I'm sorry, but here's what happened. Here's what we have decided. And we have exhausted every single remedy available to us in an attempt to help you. We're not going to be able to do it. That's sort of fewer and far between, because more often than not, there was something that happened that should not have, that allows us to be able to give better news, which is we've exhausted the resources and have determined that there's a viable theory here, something that we can move forward on. But at the end of the day, that's what we're looking for. We're trying to get it right. We're trying to make sure that the people that are injured out there are represented, in that if it's happening to that one person, then it could be happening to somebody else.
Well, the change happens in the courtroom. You know, every time I look out, when I say it every day, I hear it. I think about it every day. When my next door neighbor's truck is backing up, I hear beep, 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 beep.
Right.
I know that was because a lawyer won a case in the courtroom where somebody probably got really badly hurt. Let's do this real quick. I want to talk about the types of product liability, the range of product liability cases you just handle. I say that because when I think of product liability, I think of a defective child seat. Okay, it's a product you're buying, but you guys have talked. Give me some examples of the types of cases that you guys have handled and that you deal with here at the firm.
So you want to go back and forth? You got a couple good ones?
Yeah, we can do a little volley action.
It was a broken Pez dispenser. I get it. But
well, the obvious ones that we do, which we've already talked about that we'll rattle off quickly, are we do defectively designed vehicles that don't have safety features to protect you when you inevitably get in a crash. We've done a lot of equipment on work sites, lots of equipment on work sites, whether it be forklifts, aerial lifts, boom lifts, telehandlers, things of that nature.
Heavy equipment. Consumer products are its own realm for a host of different reasons, because in industrial commercial product cases, it's usually someone who's trained or has some level of experience, or at least should, in how to use a complex piece of equipment. A cement mixer or a scaffold. There's that built-in aspect to it. Consumer products are different in the sense that you're just someone going to a store and you're buying something.
Right.
And, God, I know I said this, and Ben and I are both in the same boat with kids of similar ages. The most horrific cases are cases involving children.
Oh, yeah.
And the most horrific case that I ever had the opportunity to work on for the benefit of the parents who unfortunately lost a daughter was a case involving a defective child's art product. And the visceral and emotional undertone of the entire thing was quite frankly juxtaposed by the guy who owned the manufacturing company who, I don't want to use the wrong words, could not have cared less. And that, to me, has always, and I suspect will for the balance of the time that I have the opportunity to do this, will always be why we serve a critical and important role in handling these products cases.
It's interesting, man. And I'm going to get, Ben, I'm going to ask.
Yeah.
So I'd like to do something called Case Watch, a case that impacted you. And you actually, people don't change things unless, I owned a hospitality business and we had a lot of doors, right? And you have a lot of partners and you're sitting there talking, well, we need to put a security guard right there. Well, we don't, okay. Now, until somebody gets through that door and something goes wrong. So people don't make common sense situations, common sense decisions, obviously, all the time, and then they get catastrophic. That's why I say change happens in the courtroom, okay? Talk about, Ben, any particular impacting cases.
We don't have enough time to go through all of the cases that have significant impact.
I'm arguing with my wife. I'm not going home.
Well, let me give you one that came to mind that, again, another product case, a consumer product, and because of the role of the lawyers in this product, it is, for the most part, has been phased out and is no longer hurting people, which is a wonderful thing. But there were ceramic fire pots. These are decorative things that go in your garden, and it's essentially a candle, but it's burning liquid fuel. And the danger, and they look like pumpkins with little hollowed out centers.
Yeah.
And here's the danger with the product. And thankfully, and if anyone, honestly, Joe, this is a great use of the media. If anyone's listening to this podcast and has one of these in the garages, don't walk. Run to your garage. Throw it away. It is horrifically dangerous. But what happens is that the fuel that burns in the central canister goes down to the very bottom, to the point where it's still superheated and there's still flame in the bottom, but it is invisible to the human eye. So you go to add more fuel and you pour a bottle, looks like a milk, like a gallon of milk. You go to pour the fuel back in. And as you do that, because there's still flame in the middle of the little ceramic container, it ignites and the fuel in your milk container, looks like a milk container, explodes outward like a flamethrower. And if you can picture a family sitting around a table, more often than not, mom or dad is pouring at a 90-degree angle. The flames are shooting right onto a child who then has, you know, essentially napalm on their body burning that you cannot put out. And that was the fact pattern that we handled here. And I was, you know, it was my honor to be involved and represent this family. Sweet, sweet kid, terribly burned. And when someone's horribly burned, there's only so much you can do. So it's an innocent child that's going to be scarred for a long, long time. I'm not going to use any names.
Sure.
But it was a product that was purchased in a grocery store that we've all been to. And it's, like I said, when it all was finished, it was a good result for everyone involved, and the case is resolved. But one of the things that I was happiest about in our pursuit of that case was digging into exactly what happened and finding all across the country other similar instances of people that had suffered burns, and then contacting them, reaching out to them, talking to them, and establishing them as witnesses to come to Philadelphia to testify in this case about how their lives had been injured and the exact defect in the product. And, you know, that's a whole other issue as to if the judge is going to let us get into that or not, but, well, we were prepared to do it, and it helped the case resolve.
And did they get rid of the product off the – is it off the shelf?
It is. It's gone.
I mean, that's – it must make you feel incredible.
Yeah.
How do you deal with that situation personally? When I sit here and I have this conversation with you guys are awesome and cool guys and all that and smart and all that, but we're doing talk radio now, okay? And I was on a job as the job steward at 47th and Lancaster. Crane operator pulls the piece up, not through the building, but up the side of the street. It hits the power lines, arcs off, hits my buddy, and knocks him off the steel. Bangs, goes all the way down. He lost his arm. He lived, thank God. But it was I was blood everywhere. I was screaming. I mean, I was like, here I am, like this macho iron worker, and I mean, there's just no chance of it. Okay. Having said that, I'm a sensitive person, like anybody. But maybe once or twice in a lifetime, you walk into somebody, like even today. You know what I mean? We first met for the first time, and I just wanted to give my condolences for your father. But if you guys deal with this situation, you're good guys and all that, but you're also smart and dealing with it. But how do you deal with it personally on an emotional level when you're dealing with people who've lost a child, who are burned in their, you know, or lost an arm or something like that? How do you do that? Really, almost every time the phone rings, that I'm not sure if that was in the college, you know, on the boards, on the, you know, when you pass your bar.
Right,
talk about that.
Yeah, so I think that it really depends on the context, and it also depends on exactly what it is that you're claiming and the folks that you're dealing with on the other side. And I know that's a lot, but there are really, really awful, horrific things that happen that are accidents, or there are really, really awful, horrific things that happen that we shouldn't call accidents because they were inevitable or they were a result of somebody being completely indifferent to something. And there's a spectrum of witnesses, right? So I know the question was more so about the inception and client
and
relationships.
And the emotional thing. How do you meet with a family who just lost and continue and still be able to maintain a legal disposition where you're thinking about the law and all that and have the resiliency to do it again and again, to load back up emotionally and be able to kind of separate things and still deal with the thing?
Well, again, when you're taking the first step and you're evaluating something and you're meeting with a family, your job is to turn over every stone, look in every nook and every cranny. But once you get into it, if you are faced with from the defense side, whoever their witnesses may be, whoever the face of the defense case may be, indifference. Someone who comes across as though he or she doesn't care.
Yeah.
You kind of get a license to react in a similar way. Now, listen, at the end of the day, we've got a job to do.
You're professional.
And you try to be objective. But the case I was just telling you about with the child's art supplies, when asked at his deposition, the owner of the company said he wasn't going to take the product off the market. I got to tell you, it was one of the most infuriating answers I've ever gotten at a deposition. So are you kidding me?
Yeah.
And here's the thing. I try to, on a regular basis, right, this is what happened at the deposition. I talk to the clients. This is where we're going. Some clients even choose to sit in on depositions and see in real time the way that things go. And each case has its own tone and temperament. Some of them are a little bit more aggressive than others. But it really is just a matter of feeling the temperature of the room and responding.
I'll tell you, I want to hear that from my attorney. You know, I want to hear my attorney. Listen, I'm a city guy. You know, I mean, at the same time, you want a professional attorney and all that. But I want to hear that when the defense attorney or the owner of the product, you know, if they say something, if they don't, if there's some non-caring there, that my attorney gets his back up, obviously to an extent. I guess that's my Philly. You want to know that your attorney's passionate like you are, and that you bleed just like I do.
Well, in answering your original question there, which is how do you deal with that? I mean, in some ways, the answer is it's difficult. How do when a client has suffered tragedy, how do you not let that affect you? I'm not sure you can. We're all human, especially being a father. Dave and I both have three kids. Mine are a couple years older, it can be very difficult when you have a young child and then you see a young child who are pure innocent victims who have been killed or tragedy has struck.
Does it inspire you?
Well, that's exactly what I was going to say. At the end of the day, my whole career, whether I was doing it initially in the criminal prosecution where we're helping the victims of crime, and now I'm very blessed to be able to do it here where we're helping people, we're discovering what went wrong and trying to remedy a wrong trying to figure out so this doesn't happen for anyone else, and being able to champion especially children, those that don't really have a voice that are
sure
blameless. Is it emotional? Is it difficult? Is it something that you can completely compartmentalize and not take home with you? No, I mean, it's not. It's part of what we do. But knowing that we're the ones trying to help, trying to give a voice to those that don't have a voice is what makes me love what I do. Because when we are successful and when David's able to hold those responsible who cost a child a life, there's no better feeling in the world.
Gentlemen, we're coming to the end of likely the fastest hour in radio. I have one question for both of you. Both of your fathers, prominent attorneys, very successful. What was the one thing that they taught you that inspired you and that you learned from every day? I'll go with David first.
Be nice to everyone. Even in the face of things that may not be going the way that you want, try to find the silver lining. And that has served me well, and I hope it continues to serve me well.
Benjamin?
I'm only allowed to say one thing?
No.
I'll say two things quickly.
Yeah, but listen,
my father taught me that cases are not won the day you show up in a courtroom. That one of his sayings was champions are made when no one is watching. That if you're going to be successful, you need to put in the work. And that can involve long nights. It can involve time away from family. You need to do what you need to do to be successful. Because by the time you show up in a courtroom, it's too late. You've either done what you need to do to win. You know the case inside and out. You know the testimony inside and out. You've secured the admissions you need. So by the time the trial starts, the case has already been won or lost before. And he taught me that there's no substitute for hard work. It was I made these comments not that long ago at in speaking of him. But the other thing my father taught me, which is sort of the other side of the coin there, and I'm very proud of him. And for as accomplished attorney and judge that my father was, he was an even better person. He was a better father. He was a better grandfather. He took time for his family and made sure, you know, when, regardless of what the professional responsibilities were, and they were significant, he would always have time to listen to his seven-year-old granddaughter who had a problem on the playground with another kid that day, and that was the most important thing in his life. So the lesson from my father is that you can be incredibly successful professionally, but the most important thing is your family, and the most important thing is being a gentleman and taking care of those that you know, you love. And that's what he taught me as well.
Just couldn't be said any better. I do want to comment. My father my father used to say to me, you don't worry about the game on game day.
Same thing, right?
Okay. And he, so if you see iron workers on a high-rise building, you'll see a lot of them wearing a shirt and it says, work hard or go home. Okay. Those things that both of you are talking about, really, they explain a lot of the type of people and attorneys you are. A gentleman, David Langsam and Benjamin Bear, I want to thank you both for being on the broadcast. Another example of why Saltz Mongoloosi and Bendesky is the firm that it is. Keep doing what you do on behalf of your clients. The change you guys make every day in the courtroom are the benefit to everybody. So I want to thank you both for being on the broadcast.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks so much. It was a pleasure.
The pleasure was mine. I want to thank everybody for tuning in to the Saltz Mongoloosi Bendesky Hour. I want to thank David Langsam, a partner here at the firm, and Benjamin Bear, also a partner here at Saltz Mongoloosi Bendesky. On behalf of David and Benjamin, I'm Joe Dougherty. Thanks for listening, everybody.